Welcome to the Great Western Forum and a festive atmosphere here in Los Angeles. It is a sellout and then some, expecting a crowd of some 12,000 people, all of them here to witness the latest chapter in the history of women's sports, the debut of the WNBA.
That was the sound of June 21st, 1997, the very first game of a brand new professional sports league, the WNBA. At so many points, including right from the outset, so many people doubted the league's future, even ridiculing the basic concept. But this Friday, the WNBA tips off its 25th season. And today, one of the league's founding players, Rebecca Lobo, takes us back in time to survey how far women's basketball has come and what its future holds. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, May 12th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by UKG. Our purpose is people. Rebecca Lobo, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely.
Rebecca Lobo is a basketball analyst for ESPN. She's also a national champion, a former WNBA All-Star, and a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame. So the WNBA season begins Friday, Rebecca. It is the league's 25th season, and I just want to get your reaction to hearing the number 25. It has been 25 years. You're one of the very first players in the league. What feelings does that evoke for you?
More than anything, pride. You know, I'm so proud that the league has lasted this long. It still makes me shake my head a little bit because it certainly doesn't feel to me like it's been around for 25 years. You know, that most of the women playing in the league now, when they were born, the league was already in existence because, of course, for most of my playing life, it wasn't here and it wasn't something that as a girl I could aspire to do. Even when I was a senior in college, there was no talk of a WNBA. So it's not something that had been in my brain when I was coming up and playing. But we've got this generation of players now who are not only playing in the league, but using it to do so much good in terms of their voices and social justice and so many things that have come together. So I'm really, really proud of these women and proud of what the league stands for.
We'll touch on the WNBA as the modern game we know it now in a little bit, Rebecca, but I hope you don't mind jumping into the time machine with me here today. I hope that's okay with you.
As long as it's got enough headroom, I'm good.
Let's go back to the very start, because I know you as this broadcaster for the league, a huge chunk of your life has been in this game, but when you were growing up, and basketball was only a professional endeavor for men, did any of this even feel like a possibility for you?
No, not really. I grew up in Massachusetts. When I was a kid, I was a huge Celtics fan. I think probably when I was in about sixth grade, I wrote a letter to Red Auerbach saying, I'm going to be the first girl to play for the Boston Celtics. Even as a 12-year-old, there wasn't any part of me that thought a WNBA or a women's professional league was a possibility. But for me, you know, for me as a kid, it was like, that was my dream. I was a girl. I was like, you know, why can't I be out there in that short polyester shorts like Larry Bird is playing basketball? I can remember, I think maybe in middle school or in high school, going to watch Nancy Lieberman Klein. She was the only woman playing on the Harlem Globetrotters at the time. Like, that's what it was to be a woman playing professional basketball. So it was a completely different way of thinking. For me, my goal was to get a college scholarship, play basketball in college, go overseas. I knew there was pro leagues overseas, you know, go to Italy or go to Japan or go to Spain, play for a few years, earn enough money that I would come back and go to law school or grad school or something like that. Certainly playing as a career and then even broadcasting as a career was never something that I thought would be realistic.
So let's recap the mid-90s for the listener here for a second, Rebecca, because in the mid-90s, you are the face of women's basketball. In 95, your Connecticut Huskies go 35-0. You win the national title. In 96, you're part of that legendary 96 women's team that won gold in the Olympics in Atlanta. Do you remember when you first heard the rumblings that the WNBA was a thing that could come into reality? What was your sense of what that would even be like?
I think it was about 95, 96 when there's a national team together. We're getting ready to play for in the Olympics in Atlanta in 96, where we first started hearing talk of not only of a WNBA, but of the other professional league that started at the same time, the ABL. So I think that's the first time most of us were like, oh, wait a minute. We don't have to go overseas. We might be able to stay here and play professional basketball. And that was really the first time where it felt like a realistic thing that a woman in this country was going to be able to do.
I want to go to your decision here, because there was a decision, capital D, before LeBron, Rebecca. People should know you had to make a difficult call on this, because the American Basketball League, which had launched in 96, and the WNBA, which got created in 97, as you just alluded to, those were the two options you had. And I remember we were looking through the archives, Rebecca, and you were interviewed about this by our own Bob Lee. And you said this.
When November comes around and I continue talking to the WNBA, I realize that this is something I would love to be involved with. They had their full support behind it, David Stern's full support behind it, money and backers, and you know that it's going to be run in a first-class way. And I said, this is what I want to do.
So for all those reasons, Rebecca, you ultimately chose the WNBA. And how difficult was that decision?
It was an extraordinarily difficult decision for a number of reasons. Every single one of my national team teammates, every single one of them had signed to play for the ABL. Every single one, except for me.
Oh, wow.
And I was already the youngest on the team. I was already the least experienced on that national team. So there was a lot of pressure and a lot of conversations from those teammates. Those are the women I was living with them. I was practicing with them every day. We were a team trying to get to the Olympics and win a gold medal. It was really, really challenging, really, really hard. And fortunately, at the time, I had an agent who just said to me, he said, you know, look at what the NBA has. Look at the backing that is there. I just kind of knew in the back of my mind that the WNBA had a better chance to have long-term success.
And part of that formula for success, Rebecca, it is very worth mentioning, was this massive marketing campaign. And it was you, it was Cheryl Swoops, it was Lisa Leslie, and the ad campaign was called We Got Next.
One, two, three. We got next!
The commercial, which I watched, I believe, somewhere between 5 and 5 million times growing up, it featured the three of you dressed in leather jackets. And you had these WNBA gym bags slung casually over your shoulders. You were walking down a hallway. You guys were exuding swagger. I remember this commercial being everywhere.
First of all, it was a great marketing campaign, because anybody who's ever played basketball in those days in particular, when you played pickup, it was We Got Next. Every single person could relate to that tagline. And you're right, it was relentless. It was probably the strongest the NBA has ever marketed the WNBA.
Yes.
You know, I can remember watching like the Eastern Conference Finals, Western Conference Finals, then ultimately the NBA Finals, and like commercials, We Got Next, June 21st or whatever the date was. Like, they pitched that hard.
We just want people to see what a great game women's basketball is, and we know they're going to love it and come back for lots more.
And we'll see more than 18.
And what's funny is, for a long time, Lisa, Cheryl, and I were the only players that were signed with the WNBA, you know, in those early days. So they had no other options. We were the faces. We were at NBA All-Star. We were here. We were there because there was nobody else. One of my favorites, there's a picture from early on, and it's me, Lisa, and Cheryl. I'm hunched over. I think Lisa's like down in a pose, and Cheryl's standing there. And we're wearing, you know, like a reversible jersey and basketball shorts with the WNBA logo on them. And the reason we're wearing those is because they didn't have team logos yet. They didn't have uniforms. They didn't have any of that stuff.
The idea of you promoting this fancy new basketball league, but having like the merchandise of one of those movies that has none of the rights to the actual logos. Like, that's incredible.
That's exactly right. So when you look like early on, you know, and this was like less than a year until Ultimate Tip. So that first bunch of months where the three of us are out there, you know, doing everything we can to promote this league, you know, we knew what cities we were going to be in. Like, I didn't even know that New York was going to be called the Liberty. Lisa didn't know that LA was going to be called Sparks. We didn't know what the uniforms were going to look like. We're just in these like generic WNBA branded things. It was the beginning. It was the beginning. And now it's like, wow, it was the beginning of 25, hopefully plus years of great basketball.
Do you have favorite moments on the court in the history of the league? Like, what do you like to watch over and over again if there is something that sort of meets that particular nostalgia.
Well, you know what's funny is I do have some VHS tapes. I, however, do not have a VCR, so I don't go back and watch anything. Like sometimes, you know, you'll be on your Twitter feed or something. I'm like, oh wait, someone like there's a clip of me back when I was playing, and that's like the only time you'll ever see it. But some of my favorite memories, of course, the first game, the New York Liberty at the LA Sparks, was the first game in the history of the league.
And that'll do it here at the Great Western Forum. It's the New York Liberty over the LA Sparks in the first game for the women's NBA. The final, 67-57. We'll be back.
We won, so that makes it a fond memory. And one of my most fond memories is our home opener with the New York Liberty.
And good afternoon, everyone. I'm Mike Green along with Megan Patterson. It is awfully loud in here, and it's the summer, and basketball is certainly in full bloom here at Madison Square Garden. A lot of hype.
I don't know how many games we played on our West Coast swing before we had our own home opener, but we'll come out for warmups. And I remember our GM, Carol Blazejowski, who was a legendary player in her day, had told us, like, every team was required to spend $10,000 on this, like, black draping that they would use in the upper bowl of all, because we all played in NBA arenas, that they would use to cover the upper bowl in the arena so that if we only had a few thousand fans, it wouldn't look like, you know, an empty arena. So we're back at home opener. The place is going nuts. And it's so loud in there that when they did the introductions of the starters, we couldn't hear our own names.
And now, please welcome the 1997
So I remember, like, you know, and starting at forward, you know, or starting at center, Kim Hampton. But we just looked at each other, and then finally somebody would have heard and, like, pushed Kim so she would run out for starting lineups. And I remember that for me, too, like, looking around, and finally I think it was Sue Wicks who, like, pushed me, and I was like, oh, I guess it's my time to run out.
Players with goosebumps as they perhaps never expected anything quite like this here at the world's most famous arena, a complete laser show and crowd so into it. Of course, Rebecca.
The arena was that loud. Madison Square Garden, the world's most famous arena, was so loud with people so excited for this first New York Liberty home game that you couldn't even hear the PA announcer. While the $10,000 worth of draping were folded up in a storage room somewhere in the back because they were worried we wouldn't have enough fans. That will always be one of my fondest memories.
All right, Rebecca, after the break, how your league and its players have changed over the last quarter century.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So, Rebecca, something that I find fascinating is the fact that the WNBA did not have a players' association when it first launched. The union had formed in 1998, and there was no CBA, there was no collective bargaining agreement with the league until 1999, and I know you were a part of all of that. So what did that very first CBA mean to both the players and the league?
Well, I was on that executive committee that helped bargain that first agreement. And And it's funny when you look back, especially when you compare it to the CBA that the women, you know, signed just, I think, a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, the most recent one. Mm-hmm. Our biggest negotiating item that first year was year-round health insurance. Players only had health insurance for the duration of the 4 or 5 month season.
Wow. Did that feel like a radical demand at the time?
Not to us. Like, how it ended up being something that the league needed to negotiate, I don't know. But it was certainly a step forward, you know, that we were unionizing. That was a big deal. All right, we're going to have a union. And PR was completely on our side, because how can you fight with women who are saying, all we really want is year-round health insurance, not this five-month deal anymore.
It's insane.
You know, we want to be able to visit our doctor in November and not just in June.
I want to skip ahead now to the 2000s, because at that point, the WNBA is growing in popularity. Two independently owned franchises are added, the Connecticut Sun, Chicago Sky, in those cases. But around this time, six WNBA franchises, Rebecca, had folded because of low attendance, because of revenue issues. Five teams got relocated. At this point, when all of this sort of turbulence is roiling the league, are you concerned about the future of the league?
Every time there was a new CBA, I was concerned. I was with the Connecticut Sun their first year as a franchise. So that's 2003. And then I retired. And so once I retired, there was concern, because I was like, you know, I was one of the people who was there at the beginning. We've got to make sure that this thing continues. And a lot of that was growing pains. A lot of that was, you know, different models. You know, you had all the NBA owners, you had expansion one year. One year we expanded too much, got up to 16 teams, then we contracted. And every time there was a contraction, a team folded, a team relocated, it was, you know, the story was, oh, this is the death of the WNBA.
Now, 5 years ago, the shock came from Detroit. And over the last 4 years, the shock record has been, well, not good.
Of course women's sports can't succeed. Of course there can't be a successful professional women's basketball league. It's like that's what people were waiting for. Every single time there was a negotiation between the leagues and the teams, you know, I would have that thought in my mind of, are the players going to ask for too much? Are they going to push the boundaries too hard, where the league just says, you know what, it's not worth it anymore? And I think the players have done a beautiful job of pushing just the right amount. And the owners and the WNBA have done a good job of saying, all right, we need to still be a successful business, but at the same time, we need to invest in women. And I feel like they've been working really well hand in hand to try to help those two paths to continue to go forward.
When you look, Rebecca, at the 2020 CBA now, and again, like, your initial request at the very beginning was health insurance year round. How dare you demand that? To now, this suite of monumental changes that I will enumerate them here. Significant increases to player cash compensation benefits, but also enhanced travel standards, expanded career development opportunities, new childcare, maternity, progressive family planning benefits, all of that stuff. When you watched that from afar, what stood out to you among those things that were just won by this union?
I think it was the things like the progressive family planning and the maternity leave or the childcare, because those are female specific. Those are women specific issues in a lot of ways. There were lots of stories I was hearing from players, you know, who had pushed off having a family because they were in the prime of their career and they didn't know how getting pregnant and having a child would impact that. I got married in 2003, that April, played the 2003 season, knew I wanted to start a family. So that meant I retired. And so, you know, the family planning, whether it's the cost to freeze your eggs or whatever it is that are really specific to professional female athletes, you know, and NBA guys aren't talking about this. Those were the things that I thought were really important and really big, because it was the players saying these things are important to us. And it was the league saying, yes, we understand you as women have some unique things that are important and we care about those and we're going to help you with those. Maybe it'll have a broader impact on women in the workplace saying, yeah, in some cases, women need different things. And the WNBA stepped up in a big way on those.
So you retired from the league in 2003, Rebecca, and obviously now you're a broadcaster. You've seen everything from all sorts of vantage points. How would you describe how the league has changed over that time? Now, looking at the sweep of all of this, how different, how do you trace that arc?
It's changed in such big ways. I mean, number one, the play on the court. You know, the first year of the WNBA, all the talent wasn't in the WNBA. You had an ABL, and it had a huge chunk of the best women's basketball players were in that league as well. So if you look at, you know, games, get out the VHS tapes and look at games from, you know, the early few years of the WNBA to now, it's not even close. Like the play is, it's at such a high level now. There's so many good players, especially because there's only 12 teams. You know, there's so many good players who aren't even on a roster because there simply isn't room. So that is one area where the league has really changed and really grown. I think the other area is that the women have really found their own voices. You know, back in my day, the kind of the social climate, the political climate was very, very different. And so the women weren't as outspoken. They weren't as comfortable being outspoken, weren't as comfortable with who they were and what they stood for and their ability to communicate that in a big way. And you compare that to the 2020 season when the women were in the bubble in Orlando and standing up for social justice issues, taking their few days where they paused and came together and had a really strong collective voice in speaking out on what was right and what was wrong, you know, dedicating this season to social justice, to Breonna Taylor. And, you know, I get to cover these women in college. I get to cover them in the WNBA now. And, you know, they never surprise me. They never surprise me because they're just such thoughtful and forceful women who know their voices, know their strength, and seem to always be standing up for what is right.
So as we look from the rearview mirror now right out the windshield here, Rebecca, what are you most excited about when it comes to the future of this league as it embarks on its, as you say, quarter century birthday?
I just feel like the WNBA is on the verge of like exploding in a big way. And I don't think it started last year, but last year was a big piece of it. You know, when you saw LeBron James and all those guys wearing their orange hoodies, that was a piece of it. Kobe Bryant and Gigi were a big part of that. Kobe sitting courtside at the All-Star game in Vegas with Gigi. Kobe going to UConn games with Gigi. Like, that was part of it. Whoever the guys out there were who were kind of trashing the WNBA, who cares? Kobe Bryant's sitting courtside with his daughter. Who cares? LeBron James is here. Who cares? So I just feel like we're ready for people in a bigger way to embrace the WNBA. The product is phenomenal. We still have to appreciate and like soak in every second that we get to see Diana Taurasi and Sue Bird play. Brianna Stewart, the MVP from a couple of years ago, who was coming off an MVP campaign with her Russian team. Asia Wilson was the MVP in the WNBA last year. Phenomenal talent. Elena Deladon, another MVP coming off injury. We have our eyes on her. Sabrina Ionescu, Kennedy Carter, a couple really young, exciting players. Arike Ogunbowale. I think we're really at a time where mainstream is ready to embrace this sport, embrace the WNBA in a way we haven't seen before.
Rebecca Lobo, thank you for going back to the future with us on ESPN Daily.
Thank you.
For more on the 2020 WNBA season and the WNBA bubble, check out the new documentary from ESPN Films. It is called 144, and it's the inside story of what unfolded for 144 WNBA players over that tumultuous three-month season. 144 premieres tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Up next, the greatest athlete in the world is Vladimir Putin, and I dare you to tell him otherwise.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Here's another story I want you to know. Everyone always says that Father Time is undefeated, but Father Time has clearly never played hockey against Vladimir Putin. You may know that the autocratic Russian president is an acclaimed martial artist and topless horseback rider and auto racer and swimmer. But this week, Putin laced up his skates in Sochi and apparently transformed once again into one of the greatest hockey prospects on our planet at age 68. And Putin did more than just outplay Russian legends like Pavel Bure and Slava Fetisov in this annual All-Star exhibition. Putin scored. And scored. And scored.
Центр. Ой, классный пас и бросок. Это гол. Это хет-трик Владимира Путина. Пока
and scored.
Делает результативный пас. Но Владимира Путина это покер, друзья.
And scored.
И здесь момент, и это пентатри.
Что он творит, Владимир Путин? Как здорово обыграл.
And scored.
А тем временем.
А у нас еще один гол.
Да, 8-2 и снова Владимир Путин, его шестая.
And scored.
И Путин! Очередная шайба в воротах.
And you guessed it.
Не было! Вот до этого мгновения Владимир Путин с центра чужой зоны отправляет.
He finished the night with 8 goals in all, doing whatever he wanted to the defense, and all of it would add up to an absolute performance for the ages. If Putin didn't do this pretty much every single year now, with the game only getting canceled last year because of COVID. In fact, back in 2019, Putin also scored 8 goals. Reportedly. And I do have to say reportedly here because that number, as yes, you might imagine, has since been challenged and officially fact-checked on account of seeming, you know, kinda unrealistic. Because according to the Kremlin, the great and powerful Vladimir Putin did not score 8 goals that night. He scored 10. So as you're watching Connor McDavid and Sidney Crosby in the playoffs this weekend, and you're marveling at their dominance in the NHL, just remember that there is a 68-year-old man who could easily do all of that if he wanted to. Or else. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.